Welcome to Lessons to Grow, the podcast on effective leadership in times of change. I'm Armin El Rao, an international manager and entrepreneur. Today is a milestone. You're listening to the 200th episode of Lessons to Grow, and it's my first episode that I give in English. I'd like to talk about good bosses and bad bosses, about what I've experienced in my own career, what I've learned from it, and what you might be able to take away from it as well. And all of that comes right after the intro. Good boss, bad boss. That's the name of this episode. We're all familiar with good cop, bad cop. We're also familiar with rich dad, poor dad. And I'll say this in all modesty. Been there, got the t-shirt. I've been part of the C-suite myself. I've worked closely with the so-called superstars of the corporate world. In Germany, the UK, France, Switzerland. In international settings, both within and outside of companies and organizations. I've seen a great deal over the years. So for the 200th episode, I want to pull back the curtain a little. It's about patterns, good bosses, bad bosses, different types of people, mentors, clients, investors, in all situations where you're dependent, whether formally or emotionally. But first of all, thank you. Thank you for your trust. Thank you for your loyalty. We're approaching 10,000 streams on Lessons to Grow, have just under 500 subscribers, and I'm truly delighted that this collection of experiences, which I'm sharing from around 20 years of international management and now over 10 years of entrepreneurship, as well as the way I put things into perspective as far as good corporate leadership is concerned, is clearly appreciated. So let's dive right in, and I'll start with the bad bosses. There was, for example, the computer scientist with a PhD, a solid technical expert, a bit of an eccentric, a bit of a colorful character, quite amusing, but then he suddenly became the boss of about 30 people. As a manager, he was completely unsuitable. That's a pattern I've seen quite often. The expert, the creative oddball, the technically strong person is made into a manager. After that, things get difficult for everyone. The employees have to figure out how to deal with it. And eventually, everyone starts finding their own workarounds. Then there's the other type, which is far more unpleasant. People who compensate for being overwhelmed, stressed, or feeling insecure by having emotional outbursts. I've seen everything, right up to the hot-tempered type. It must be said, however, that in the early years of my career, authoritarian leadership was still absolutely the norm. Intimidating employees was also common. It was part of the business. Many things that were normal back then, you simply couldn't do today. And that's a good thing. We employees learned back then to deal with it somehow. You swallowed it. You took it. You tried to get through it. Today, I would say, emotions and facts must be kept separate. Anyone who wants to lead must have their emotions under control, and especially when they are strong, all the more so. My father used to say sometimes when we were kids and being stubborn. Go bang your head against the wall 3 times. Maybe that'll make things better. Of course, you don't have to take it that far or see it that way. And in my father's case, too, it was essentially a way of getting things across through exaggeration. But the point is clear. First, calm down, breathe. Then look at the facts. How do you deal with bosses like that? With true hotheads or people who use psychological terror, there are only limited options. You can address it directly. Most of the time, this doesn't get you very far, because such people often resort to making excuses. You can't take the official route through the proper channels. In a corporation, that would be the HR department, for example. That's often difficult too, because you're then quickly accused of a lack of loyalty, or you get subtle feedback that you shouldn't have escalated the issue, or maybe even that you are too sensitive. All of that happens. If someone is putting employees on display, belittling them, or systematically intimidating them, I would say today, either go through official channels or go straight to the CEO or the manager in charge. And if the CEO or the manager in charge does not stand behind you, then leave. There are some things that are simply unacceptable. And you're more valuable than you realize in that situation. Always keep that in mind. Your position is always stronger than you think it is. I used to put up with far too much out of fear, because of my career, because of the next position, because of the investor chain, as I sometimes call it today, that is, the chain of mentors who need to be satisfied or on whom you depend for your career. You think you have to somehow endure it now. Today I see it differently, though I'm fully aware that it's always difficult to look back on things with the knowledge you have now. On to the boss types. Another type of boss I've encountered is the Rumpelstiltskin. That's what I'll call him for now. Someone who was completely overwhelmed by his role, who worked himself nearly to the burn, but lacked intellectual and professional capacity to fulfill the role. He also lacked academic training in this case, which in itself wouldn't be a problem at all if someone still brought substance and leadership to the table. In this case, however, that wasn't the case. He couldn't convince us employees professionally and tried to compensate for that with subtle and sometimes less subtle pressure. And that brings us to an important point. It's always about dependency. This can happen with bosses, but it also applies to investors, mentors, clients, and board members. Whenever you're dependent or feel dependent, this power dynamic can be exploited. You might have to put up with something like that for a while. But at some time or at some point, you should look for options. You should start looking around for alternatives. That's one of the most important lessons I've learned from bad bosses. That me as somebody, or you as somebody who is affected, should, you know, not put up with it for too long. And if you are a boss, don't do it yourself later on. I did not want to become like that, not as a supervisor, not as a mentor, not as an entrepreneur, and also not as an investor. Then there's the next type, the one who sold himself to, well, very interesting case. Someone goes into a job interview, sells himself or herself brilliantly, lands a role for which they are far from prepared, and then they are stuck there. My favorite professor, Neil Thornbury from Babson College, once called this type of person the country clubber. This is someone who walks around or walks through the hallways, in this case, as if the whole place was a country club. Looking around, a bit of small talk, a bit of style, as if you were cruising on the Aida, but with little substance. And of course, no one is allowed to notice. I've seen how this kind of thing has led to millions in losses. People like that are often less unpleasant than hotheads. They don't yell. They don't necessarily apply pressure openly. But they obfuscate. They play games. They evade. And eventually, it gets expensive. And that's very dangerous. I used to have the problem that I found it hard to tolerate incompetence in a given role. And I suspect people noticed. Mediocrity too. I still have my issues with mediocrity to this day. I admit I can be radical about it sometimes. And people probably noticed that. At one point or another, I ended up having to pack it in. But in terms of substance, I stand by this. When people are overwhelmed professionally and substantively and try to cover up that overwhelm, it becomes dangerous. This runs through many bad bosses. I sometimes say casually, they had no clue. That's obviously an exaggeration. What I mean is that they are overwhelmed, not big enough for the job. In my experience, that's one of the main patterns of bad leadership. There's also the variant where someone intellectually understands exactly what they are doing. Another type of boss. They are not at all stupid professionally, but these people build a fantasy world. Happens quite a lot. They act as if they are something they aren't, and as if the team is something it isn't. Employees notice this immediately. Cynicism is often the result. And then they don't take you seriously anymore either. So here too, stick to reality. Stop building up fantasy worlds or perhaps falling for strange stories. Then I also saw the tyrant, the despot. Again, someone who was overwhelmed by the situation. He acted as if he were participatory. In reality, he wanted to control everything. Little trust in others, presumably also little trust in himself. Not a bad man at heart, but overwhelmed with the stuff that he had to manage. He was also overwhelmed in this specific field in which he was leading me back then. He had worked his way up from humble beginnings, which isn't a bad thing at all. I come from humble beginnings myself. Probably with a lot of fear in his system. And that turned him into a control freak. Clumsy in his human interactions and communication. That too is a pattern. Being overwhelmed is compensated for, sometimes through acting, through pretense, and that as it was the case with the country clubber. Sometimes it is compensated through pressure, like with the despot. In the worst case, through choleric behavior, like with the choleric. And the result is almost always the same. Employees mentally check out. Then there's the boss for whom ego and their own narrative becomes more important than the work and the company. That's very frustrating for employees. They are often intelligent people, these bosses, organized with good ideas on paper. Everything fits together perfectly. But when it comes to implementation, it misses the mark. Dreamers, people who want to be a bit of a pseudo Steve Jobs. But that doesn't fit with operational reality. These people are often resistant to advice. The ego-driven types, as I call them sometimes, quite resistant to advice. They act as if they are listening to employees, as if they are involving everyone, but in the end, they do exactly what they had planned all along. That's extremely frustrating. And here too, employees eventually check out mentally. The result is, as I said, inner resignation and cynicism. And as I've also seen, these shortcomings are transferable to other groups. I've seen investors treat founders like idiots. Really, literally. I've seen mentors yelling at their mentees. I've seen that too. I've seen clients unload their own stress onto us as entrepreneurs or service providers. It's still common. In our case, with my company, not so much, because we go to great lengths not to work with such clients. But we see it in the market. We see such cases, and the rule is always make sure you find alternatives, or rather that you already have alternatives before you get into these situations. You need to make sure that you don't have to put up with these people, you know, to get into these situations of dependencies. You know, look for new investors, or look for options in investors, jobs, clients. And yes, sometimes you also have to have the courage to part ways with a client. Don't always cave in and say, we need the money. That's nonsense. At some point, you have to have clear principles, not out of defiance, but out of self-protection and self-respect. In the corporate world, in the world of large corporations, I put up with that far too much. As an entrepreneur, I don't do that anymore. And that brings us to the topic of good bosses. And that's a whole different story. Right at the start of my career, I had a boss who was very structured, very goal-orientated, supportive and open. You could go to him. Little hierarchical posturing, yet a clear line. If something went wrong, he could also say, that won't work. That's very good leadership. Supporting while also demanding something. Listening openly. Providing direction. Drawing clear lines. Then I had a boss who really took the time, even when it came to the content of what I produced. That impressed me a lot back then. He got involved in offers, proposals, in reports, presentations, helped improve them, didn't just comment from above. Once we had a workshop on a massive proposal, it was about 135 million back then, and he was able to say, when the whole thing went astray a little bit, listen up, folks, that this isn't about blah, blah, and putting on another great workshop with a social component and some touchy-feely nonsense. This is about achieving a goal, a result. What do we need right now to achieve this result? And then all hands to the pump. They are good people, doers, people who make a difference. Yes, and then, of course, one of my great role models was Eduardo Montes. I'd like to mention him here by name. He was the former country manager or head of Siemens Spain, which was already back then, I think, a 5 billion euro company. One of my bosses who later even made it onto the Siemens executive board, thanks to his strong performance. An exceptionally good manager and leader. What made Eduardo so strong? Focus, absolute focus. Structure. Clear expectations. You always knew where you stood. No nonsense, no dreaming, no beating around the bush. And that was very, very helpful. And above all, he led by example in what he expected from others. For example, when I presented the figures, I had a monthly meeting with him where my subsidiary had to present the figures to him. It would happen that he'd say, "Armin, something's not right here. I don't get it. No me cuadra," he always said in Spanish. "No me cuadra, Armin." So he said, for example, in cell E27 in an Excel table, there's something off, and then you had to explain it to him. So that's leadership, being willing to go into detail and not always demanding. You do it, but you lead by example. Then after my time abroad, back in Germany, I had someone from whom I learned a lot about serenity, or rather, who wished me serenity. He was the first to do that. I mean, maybe many others recognized it before, but he was the first to subtly convey it to me in a dedication, in a little book that he gave to his employees. He wished me serenity, and that's when the scales fell from my eyes. And that was over 20 years ago, and I've been working on my serenity ever since. Serenity. That's a topic I've been working on my whole life, actually. And how does the saying go? Self-awareness is the first step towards improvement. At least that's what we say in Germany. And I can only advise anyone under pressure to work on it, on serenity. If you aren't naturally gifted with it, as an entrepreneur and a manager or an SME managing director, all these people with whom I share my experience as my clients, they are regularly under pressure. Some are even under constant pressure. And that's a big challenge. For me, serenity or composure means first and foremost taking things as they are, not fretting. Look at the facts. Don't wish things were different because they simply aren't. And then ask, what's the best I can make of this situation? Easier said than done, I know. Some people have this gift by nature. My father has it. He's 90 years old. My paternal grandmother had it. She lived to be 99. My father-in-law does too. He'll be 94 this year. That's admirable. I myself will probably never reach that level. I'm wired differently, more driven, more ambitious, more eager for great success. And that's the flip side of having less composure. So kind of a positive flip side, I would say, in that case. As Bruce Lee said, and that's one of my mottos, to always be happy, but never satisfied. Always be happy, but never satisfied. But as a leader, you have to display a certain kind of serenity or composure. As an example, we at my company, we didn't have a particularly good first quarter here at my agency. It wasn't exactly a home run. It wasn't life-threatening, but it wasn't the kind of result that had us all shouting, hooray. That's when you have to look at the situation calmly and objectively. Examine overhead costs, unnecessary costs. That's absolutely crucial. That's where the death of every company lies, in SG&A, in the overhead. What is really necessary? What stabilizes things? And then back to the basics. Yes, for example, in sales, having conversations, initiating conversations, having the stats right, being out there purely from a statistical standpoint, that's important, getting back on track. We manage that during the first quarter, things are looking up again. And that too has to do with composure or level-headedness. Sober-mindedness comes more easily to me personally than composure. But let's get back to the types of bosses. Then there was the mentor who gave me responsibility. Very important. He was, at that point in time, the CEO of a billion-dollar company. I was anchored somewhere in the lower ranks of the hierarchy. And he discovered me. He once sent me to Sydney to evaluate an outsourcing opportunity. Commonwealth Bank of Australia. I can say that now, a big bank, it's ages ago. And there I was, supposed to prepare a decision deck or decision memo. I took that very seriously, of course, because I'd been given the responsibility. And I think I did a good job. My mentor, the CEO, was of the same opinion. And so you can see how a leap of faith can lead to good performance. It does. Such a classic example of good leadership. You give someone responsibility, even a little bit more responsibility than they can certainly handle at that moment. The claim is, bite off a little more than you think you can chew. That's the principle. And then you are there as a leader. You must be there when support is needed, because otherwise there's a risk you might choke on the piece of apple you just bit off. We want to avoid that. Good leaders do exactly that. They trust. But it's not blind trust. There's a lot of misunderstanding here about trust. I've always pointed that out. You have to earn trust. Yes, leaders challenge you, they create stretch goals, and they don't leave you on your own. But you have to justify that trust. Back to the boss types. There was another absolute highlight among the types of bosses I've met, and that was a guy called David Andrews. I'm going to name him here too, by name, because he was so exceptionally good, and it's also a long time ago. Along with the mentor from the corporation I mentioned, who trusted me with Sydney and with Eduardo Montes, David Andrews is among the most inspiring leaders I've ever encountered. In any case, he was the only one who could give me goosebumps during his presentations. Why? Focus, absolute professionalism, data-driven approach. Above all, he was a great storyteller, I must say. Results-oriented, supportive, trusting, present, encouraging, and very demanding. What was truly impressive about him was his courage to stand by his principles. That was always really important. One principle, for example, in sales at the company I was working for at the time, I was the head of marketing and sales there back then, was the following. So the company generally dealt with BPO deals, more specifically enterprise partnerships, worth hundreds of millions. There was this one principle that at a certain point in the prospect's purchasing process, we had to secure exclusivity as a potential provider. So we demanded that no further discussions or conversations be held with our competitors, just with us. A $1 billion corporation wouldn't grant us that. The consequence? We walked away, as David put it. A year later, the company came back and we closed the deal. But you have to be able to afford that kind of courage. You can't make your business dependent on individual deals or transactions. That's the key point. The bottom line has to be right. And I had never experienced that kind of courage and consistency before. And with Andrews and that company, there was something else that I had never experienced before and haven't since. I call it executive discipline. You could also call it execution discipline. Very important. In other words, a very clear line. Once something was decided, it was implemented. There was no looking left or right. Sometimes what was implemented might not have been perfect. Sometimes it was wrong, but it was implemented. I have rarely seen that kind of execution strength. It was absolutely amazing. A focus on numbers is also important. That brings us to another boss I've had, or to a different culture. Give me the numbers was always the refrain at the US corporation I once worked for. Give me the figures, give me the numbers. In the end, the numbers don't lie. What good does it? What good does it do us if we're all happy and get along well, but are making losses? Yes, that's nonsense, isn't it? Numbers have to be the focus, but alongside support, conversations, and help. I remember a phone call with my boss from the US at that time. I was sitting on the ICE train, the long distance, the fast train in Germany, on my way to Berlin, and my numbers weren't quite stacking up or adding up. The call lasted maybe 10 seconds. He said, "Armin, we can't lose that much money, so do something about it." And then he hung up. That was a clear message. But I also knew that if I needed him, he'd be there. So I did something about it, as he requested, and afterwards, once it had worked out, I was, as they say, in his good books. Clear messages are important for good leadership. Clarity is important. Then there was the CEO of a major telecommunications group I got to know. He wasn't my direct boss at that time. Actually, he never was. But I had him on my radar, so to speak. He was the CEO. I was maybe on the third or fourth level of that big corporate. He had charisma, but not that artificial charisma of a despot. He had the kind who, he was the kind who, how can I say this? It was a different kind of charisma. He had international experience, a sophisticated demeanor, multilingualism, cultural affinity. If you want to become a truly good international leader, English is not enough. Just the language is not enough. You have to immerse yourself in cultures, go beyond language. You have to have an interest in, a love for culture. You have to be able to connect with people. Then you can become really good. And the best of all, they have a vision. They can lead and manage. They can articulate a vision, win people over to it, and then lead them on the path to implementation. The strongest vision I ever had with a team was when I worked in England. I was leading a pre-sales consulting team there. There were about 12 of us in total, all young people, super motivated, all with MBAs, all itching to get started and looking for big challenges. We were operating in very complex international environments, working on massive BPO deals, business process outsourcing, and occasionally on delivery as well. It was all about process know-how, financial know-how, cultural change know-how. And our vision was we make a difference. We didn't want to leave the office or the project or the bid or the deal in the evening and say, it doesn't matter whether I was here today or not. We definitely did not want that. I had experienced exactly that for 2 years in a previous role, and I know how terrible that feels. It weighed heavily on me. I wanted to feel every day that I had made a contribution to my clients, to my company, to shareholder value, to investors, to employees, to colleagues. The good ones do exactly that. They do make a difference. They can articulate a vision. They have an international presence. They have substance. So, what patterns emerge among the good leaders? Having a vision, inspiring others, trust, challenge, support, clear focus on results, uncompromising focus on results if necessary, follow through, clarity, making tough decisions, courage, execute, execute, execute. Don't just talk and then question everything again. Stick to decisions even when they have downsides, because there are no decisions without downsides. Practicing composure when it doesn't come naturally. Being there for employees. Facilitating collaboration. Focusing on win-win outcomes. As a boss, mentor, investor, and client. In all these roles. And this brings me to a part I really want to share because it explains how I myself became this international manager and entrepreneur, and what I too have learned from it, what it means for my leadership, and what you maybe can take away from it. When I was in my late 20s, I was still a software developer. My big vision was I want to become an international manager. I speak several languages at a business proficient level, and I love different cultures, a wide variety of cultures. That's always been a passion of mine. But what's important is the practical application of language. I wanted to put that to use in international management. That was, so to speak, my use case. Back then, I bought a book. I think it was called The International Manager. It was published by Ashridge Management College, which was, and perhaps still is today, though I don't follow it as closely anymore, one of the top business schools in the UK and internationally. Very strong at that time in organizational psychology, organizational behavior, and that sort of thing. I read this book while I was, as I said, still a software developer. And then I was sitting on the tube in Munich. Somewhere around Columbusplatz, or a typical U2 stop like that in Munich. A few colleagues got on and asked, "What are you reading there?" I showed them the title. I didn't say a word. And then they almost laughed themselves silly. International manager, is that what you want to be? Well, good luck with that. Well, okay, I pursued that vision anyway. Because if you have a vision, stick to it. Believe in yourself. And I told myself, if I want to become a manager, then maybe it's a good idea to learn how that actually works. Because I'd seen so many people, especially experts, who ended up becoming bad bosses, bad managers. And I definitely didn't want to become like that. So I did an MBA. Today, of course, we know that even an MBA doesn't necessarily make you a good boss. But that was my approach back then. And I did it at the renowned and venerable Henley Business School in the UK. And the MBA was a paradigm shift for me. As a graduate in computational linguistics, English and Romance languages with a master's degree, I didn't feel ready for management. Heiko Mell, at that time a top HR consultant and headhunter from Düsseldorf, advised me when I phoned him, and I quote, Now go the extra mile and get your MBA. After all, you studied something that nobody cares about. Unquote. That worked, and so I went from being a specialist to becoming a generalist and a manager. I was exotic, a software developer who had done some research in AI. I had also written my master's thesis on an AI topic. I was involved in projects for this Federal Ministry of Research and Technology in Germany. I was part of European Union projects. One was called Esprit at the time, and so on. Even wrote a book with two colleagues on AI, on an AI topic. And then management came into the picture, and that was my catalyst. Then things really took off. By the age of 37, I was in the upper echelons of a major corporation on the fast-track career route, truly among the youngest there, an elite circle of people. I then took on country management positions in very complex environments, matrix structures, international settings, different cultures, different languages, highly complex challenges, very often with my back against the wall. Very often. I changed companies, salaries doubled. At times I was truly paid a princely sum. Today, I sometimes say, it was compensation for pain and suffering. That might sound like a hero story, a bit melodramatic, pathetic, but a hero story actually looks different. For me, there was fear. There was total uncertainty. There was pain. But without fear and without pain, you don't make progress either. An athlete who isn't willing to suffer won't get better and in the end will not succeed. No pain, no gain, as Neil Thornberry from Babson College once told me. For me, things really got down to the nitty-gritty at times. I once had a panic attack in the airport lounge in Madrid. It wasn't until many years later that I realized it was a panic attack. I'm over 60 now, and that was the only phase, thank God, in my life where things got that bad, where something like that happened, because I simply put so much pressure on myself just to get ahead. Those are the downsides. I've been fired from projects because I spoke my mind, even from leadership positions. I've fallen victim to cost-cutting programs because they simply let go of whoever was the most expensive, even if I'd done a good job. Sometimes a career stalls because you're in the wrong network or because the network you were in suddenly dissolves. That happened to me too. Sometimes you just fall flat on your face. My leadership principles emerge from all of this, from my good bosses, my bad bosses, and from my own story. That's why I told it. I don't want to call it leadership or management doctrine or philosophy. This also may be a little bit of the wrong term. These days, even soccer or football players have a philosophy. And I would rather call it my thoughts, my leadership thoughts, my thoughts on leadership. And they are relatively simple. First, results come first. Everything else is nonsense. If results don't come, and results have to come relatively quickly, because you can't do the round for years just because you have a great idea and think it'll work out somehow, if they don't come quickly, there's no point. If you're Amazon and can invest hundreds of millions or billions, that's a different story. But for most companies, the rule is we have to achieve positive results quickly. Second, you need a compelling vision. Like with We Make a Difference, you then have to rally people behind you who are willing to walk the path with you and carry that vision with you. Third, you have to be there for your people. It's essential. And you can't bask in success when things are going well and then look for someone to blame when the whole thing hits a wall. That's just not acceptable. Fourth, you have to be able to take criticism, probably one of the hardest things. People are always so quick to claim, yeah, I can take criticism. But let yourself be criticized really harshly. Then you'll see just how well you can take it. You have to accept that criticism and resolve to do better. And that is extremely important. Then fifth, just as important, check your ego at the door. Ego is a hindrance. Ego, or an inflated ego, isn't helpful. Expertise, substance, reality, that's what matters. You also have to be willing to make a U-turn, to turn back and not charge towards the abyss like a lemming just because the sun is shining so beautiful beyond it. I've seen that happen too. That's the famous line, I'll get the company back on track through the top line. The problem is, it doesn't help. It's not the right approach. If you're in a boat with a leak, you have to plug the leak, bail out the water, plug the leak. It's not about stoking the longing for the island you see 2 kilometers ahead of you and then make people row like crazy. Sixth, demand. Make them grow by demanding a lot. And at the same time, nurture. Be there. Support. Be human. Demand results. Be clear about the positives and the negatives. Don't be afraid of clear statements. Don't be afraid to part ways with people sometimes. That is, in essence, what I've learned from my own experience and what I practice today in my company, what I learned from the people I worked with, the good bosses, the bad bosses. And as I said, I apply it in my company with just under 20 employees right now. From my own experience, I'm saying, and of course from both the good bosses and the bad bosses, that's something that is worth thinking about. And interestingly, my employees reflect exactly these principles back to me. They talk about motivation, decisiveness, interpersonal communication, making decisions without fear, whether positive or negative. Listening, respect, admitting mistakes, learning from mistakes, and being trustworthy, appreciative, and demanding. That makes me happy, of course, because it shows that something from all I've experienced has stuck. Finally, here are the do's and don'ts from this episode. The don'ts first. Don't pretend you're not overwhelmed if you are. Don't create a fantasy world. Don't compensate for uncertainty with pressure. Don't become a hothead. Don't belittle employees. Don't feign involvement when you've already made up your mind. Don't put your ego above the course. Don't abuse dependency. And if you find yourself in such a dependency, look for options, other investors, other customers, a different role. Sometimes walking away is the best decision. And now the do's. Create clarity. Provide direction. Trust. Challenge. Encourage. Listen. Make decisions. Stick to the facts. Practice composure. Go back to the basics when things get tight. Look at the numbers. Stay human. Be there for your people. Turn talent into responsibility. Stand by your decisions, even if they have downsides. Be courageous, be bold, and above all, make a difference. That's perhaps the sentence that stuck with me the most. I'm absolutely thrilled that I've stuck with these 200 episodes and that you've stuck with me, both, of course, with a wink. I'm happy that you remain loyal, that you're interested in what I have to share. Sometimes you might disagree. Very well. Then we can talk about it, maybe even argue a bit. I look forward to every comment. Lessons to Grow continues with expert discussions, with From Practice for Practice, which is a series, and with the flagship episodes, the C-level views in which impressive personalities from the C-suite of the boardrooms of German and international corporations and also from SMEs do me the honor of joining me for a chat. And, of course, it will continue with my insights. The insights of Armin L. Rau on good corporate leadership in times of change. And one more thing, one more really last thing now to conclude right at the very end. I dedicate this episode to all the people from whom I've had the privilege of learning, for better and for worse. My former bosses, my mentors, my coaches, my customers, my clients, my investors, my colleagues, and my fantastic current and former employees. And I dedicate this episode especially to my storytelling coach, Uwe von Grafenstein, who passed away far too soon last year. Without Uwe, there probably wouldn't be 200 episodes of Lessons to Grow. Thank you, Uwe, and thanks to the entire team at Geschichten, die verkaufen, in English, Stories that Sell. I look forward to the next 200 episodes of Lessons to Grow. Until then, it's all about growth.